The Veritas Radio Network and the Crusade Channel present Kurt Wallace's The Flow. Real interviews with real people revealing real truths. Heard exclusively on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade Channel and available online at veritasradionetwork.com. Radio, the way it should be.
Presented by Veritas Radio Network, I'm Kurt Wallace, and this is The Flow. Our guest today is Adam Kokesh, TV radio talk show host, social, political, and anti-war activist, author of the wildly popular book Freedom, and a U.S. Marine. Sits down with me to discuss his life growing up in California and how his parents' divorce shaped his anti-authoritarian views. He shares specific insights given to him by a close relationship with his father and mother, respectively. He talks about what it was like being the only white kid to attend an American Indian prep school. As a U.S. Marine, he describes torturing people in Iraq, a past he's had to face. Kokesh explains why he's recently stopped using marijuana, taking a different approach in dealing with his post-traumatic stress disorder. He then tells us about his spirituality and why he's no longer an atheist. He goes into great detail about evolving in his work as an activist and a person, providing insight into his own fears after being arrested over 36 times for acts of civil disobedience. This is an interview you won't hear anywhere else. And Adam, thanks for spending time with us today on The Flow.
My pleasure.
Now, we know a lot about you. If anybody has been paying attention to the Liberty Movement, they know who Adam Kokesh is. And kind of the purpose of these interviews with myself on The Flow is to kind of explore what's underneath and the things that we've experienced in our worlds. And you grew up in, where did you grow up? I know you were born in San Francisco, but where did you end up?
Wait. I have to challenge the premise of your question, just being such a raging contrarian here in the first place anyway. But really, what makes you think I grew up?
Okay. Where you were born, and then where did you live the first, say, 10 years of your life?
Yeah, I sort of grew up in the Bay Area, in nice suburbs of San Francisco, in between San Francisco and San Jose, San Mateo, Burlingame, Burlingame Hills, Atherton for a while. I mean, pretty nice neighborhoods mostly. And my parents got divorced when I was 10, so I bounced around a lot. And then my dad moved to New Mexico, and I did my last 2 years of high school at Native American Prep, and was the only white kid to have ever attended the school. It actually disbanded, I guess you could say, 2 years after I graduated with the smoke-free class of 2000. And I was part of a graduating class of 15 students.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. Well, how did you end up going to a Native American school, being the only white kid there?
My dad knew the headmaster, and there was only one student there who was paying full tuition. So then I went there, and then there were two students paying full tuition. And I had just gotten kicked out of a really good boarding school in Colorado for possession of alcohol, and needed, my dad wanted to, you know, salvage my academic career. And at that point, it really was quite a brilliant move.
So when you were in boarding school, were you like a troublemaker, or you're a contrarian, that type? Is that kind of how you?
Yeah, I wasn't the worst, but yeah, I was always, you know, just outside the rules. I had a locked suitcase when I was at boarding school in Colorado full of my contraband, and it was just wine and tobacco products, I think. Maybe I had weed, like, at one point or another. But, I mean, I wasn't bad. I was always just, like, part of me had to, like, maybe this is such a weird, like, self-reflective epiphany happening right now, but It was like I always had to have something that I was doing that was contrary to authority. Like, I always had to have something that asserted my freedom. Like, if I, you know, and even when I was in jail, like, there was always something I had to do to be like, no, I'm not obedient. I don't belong to you. And it goes way back to then, at least. And I got caught one night with, can't even remember how it happened, but they searched my room and I had 2 bottles of wine. And so I got kicked out.
Maybe somebody had a vendetta. one of your friends turned you in, or enemies.
No, I would have remembered that. That's funny. I've never told this story, like, not for years. I mean, I haven't told the story at least since college to anyone. And it's not like it's some huge thing. It's never come up. It's something I got kicked out for alcohol. But I remember my room being searched. I really don't remember what precipitated it. I think I got in trouble for something else. And, like, we were running around at night after curfew. And, like, it's funny because I was a virgin until I was 19, but I stuck into the girls' dorm with a bunch of buddies in high school. And we snorted no-dos. We snorted caffeine, ground-up caffeine pills. Like, it was silly, harmless stuff like that. And it was something to do with, like, getting caught coming back into the dorm or something like that. And then they searched our rooms and I got caught.
So this whole idea of going to boarding school, and this is kind of an elite boarding school that you went to, I guess. It was Stevenson School. Is that the name of it?
Yeah, the first high school I went to was in California. It was Robert Louis Stevenson in Pebble Beach, and that's a real prep school, you know. Mm-hmm. Most of the kids who graduate there go to Ivies. And then I chose to leave because I didn't like the student group scene. Like, I really just, they were snobs. It was really stratified, and I didn't like it. So, mm-hmm. At least that was my view at the time. And I went to Fountain Valley School of Colorado in Colorado Springs, where they had a horse riding program. And that was really cool. I helped dehorn and castrate some calves and got to spend some time on playing polo cross, working with draft horses. And so I was there for 1 year, and then that was my sophomore year. And then I think it was just less than a month into my junior year was when I got kicked out. But too bad, I really liked it there.
And so going to boarding school, you're not with your family. Is it a sense of that this is the way it works, or... I've always wondered if parents put kids in boarding school because they don't know what to do with them, or they don't want to have them like that. That's what I might have had that attitude.
Sometimes that's the case, and I should say I did get in trouble for something a little more intense in middle school, and I got arrested. I might have like a juvenile record. I don't even know, mm-hmm. but I set off a fireball bomb in the boys' bathroom, but it was more of a prank. Like burn toilet paper.
Nowadays, you'd get arrested, tased, beaten up, and then they'd call your parents.
Yeah, no, the police. They took me in and booked me, and I had to go and like sit with them for some of their counseling session. It was stupid, but no. The reason I went to boarding school, and it was like my dad went to Culver Military Academy. Ended up protesting, not protesting, but dodging the draft out of conscience for the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. But you did have that military boarding school academy background, at least. And so it wasn't new. My mom went to high school, I'm pretty sure, in her hometown in Baie-Dauphine, Montreal, or somewhere in the area. Mm-hmm. Oh, gee. If I got that wrong, she's going to kill me. No, she's great. But then she did go to college in Wellesley, and that's when she met my dad at Harvard. So for me, when I had the choice, it was actually offered to me as, you want to go to boarding school? And I was like, yes, I want to get away from going 1 week with one parent and 1 week with another.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's how it is with my son. We have joint custody. So going through, you said your parents got divorced when you were 10. What was that a significant moment in your life? Was it, obviously not wanting to go 1 week and 1 week every, you know, between houses must have affected you. But what has that meant to you, having your parents divorce at that age?
I mean, I wish I had a ready answer to that question and can say, like, this is how it affected me. But I guess it's kind of a lot that I've outgrown and blocked out and just have never really cared to revisit. And at this point, it doesn't bother me at all to as a matter of, introspective intellectual curiosity. So I suppose I didn't have that rebellious streak at all before then. I mean, maybe like in an inherent way, but not the same just deliberate way when I was a younger kid. I mean, I played soccer and baseball in school and was always just, I was a fun, nerdy, like in the nature and plants kid. And then I got this rebellious streak, when my parents got divorced, because I think it just, your vision of authority is very much based on your experience with your parents, and no different for me. And I always tell people that like 10 is about the worst age. I mean, the range of like, and I don't know the exact statistics. There are probably statistics that could make this point better for me, but that if you're like somewhere between 6 and 12 years of age, that's the worst time to go through your parents getting divorced. I was 10, my brother was 8. Mm-hmm. And if you're younger than 6 and your parents get divorced and they become happy co-parents, it's like that's all you remember. It doesn't really challenge you. Or if you're older than 12, you have enough of a sense of who you are as an adult, you can understand it. But when you're 10 and 8, it's like a traumatic experience. Maybe traumatic is the wrong word, but it's certainly, a major experience. And that was a big part of my, what made me who I am. But my parents were also, both very smart and both somewhat anti-authoritarian themselves, and my dad liked to tell stories about how he sort of beat the school system growing up and because he outsmarted them. And, my mom was a big oldies fan, so I grew up with the lyrical spirit of the 60s rebellion music in my ears. And I think all that contributed to it.
Hmm. So the relationships with your mom and your dad, obviously they're going to be different because they're different people, but in terms of...
Very.
Yeah, and in terms of that, what was that, I mean, what kind of impact did they have on you that's kind of shaped your worldview then, and as individual people? Because you mentioned that they were both kind of anti-authority on some level, but...
Yeah.
And you cited a couple of examples, but just in terms of the relationship, do you remember, like, moments or conversations that you've had with your mom and your dad? Separately?
Oh, of course, but I think it would be more helpful to discuss the positive things of what I got from them. And uh-huh. My dad is a brilliant man. I mean, just and the horsepower that he has is incredible. Sometimes he would give me lectures in the car growing up and teach me how to do math in my head and understand the stock market and stuff like that. And this
really?
Is my
Wow.
middle school education was, when I was going to school the few days with him, that he would explain those kinds of things to me. He also gave me a great sense of drive and purpose and getting things done, a sort of logistician's kind of approach to things, like that there's a procedure and there's a way of calculating what are the resources that need to come together to make something happen. And I've really valued that I got that experience from him. My mother is, I know it sounds like almost a cheesy cliche, but such a self-aware, compassionate person. And I think I got a lot of, I don't want to say my selflessness, because I intellectually now, like, I really don't believe there is such a thing as selflessness. I'm with Ayn Rand on this one point, mm-hmm. a lot of points, but this one in particular, that there's really no such thing as altruism. And my activism is greedy, even though I'm doing it for other people, mm-hmm. it's not because of their preferences necessarily. And yes, with the message of freedom, of course, it's all about empowering people's preferences without any coercion being used against them. But it's because I want to see people do well. I want to see people be happy. That's what I want. It's serving my vision. And I think I got a lot of that from my mother and her wisdom.
That's it's interesting. You bring up this sort of philosophy about selflessness, and mm-hmm. I kind of have this as a contention as well. And you're a psychology major, so you've spent a lot of time understanding human behavior just from an mm-hmm. academic standpoint, and mm-hmm. then going on and all of the experiences that you've had post-college, which are tremendous real-world education. In this particular mindset, helping someone is actually a selfish motive. And,
yes.
And any time that someone challenges the philosophy of liberty or libertarianism or anarchism, there is this idea that they're very selfish, or that we or people like with this type of philosophy are very selfish. And it's actually in my best interest to lift up people around me, because if I'm not lifting the people up around me, somebody who's on the street, who's struggling, then they're going to become a bad actor. So it's actually mm-hmm. in my benefit to always try to lift others up so that my world is better in my own
Absolutely.
Community.
Yeah, it's a better way to be more generous. It's not like selfishness is good and selflessness is bad. Mm-hmm. It's just that there are different ways of approaching human relationships, you know, and when you're doing everything for yourself, it's actually a better way to connect with other people, because we all inherently want to see other people do well and be happy. But it's just important to recognize the psychological reality of this is that it's we want or I want other people to be happy. Mm-hmm. Maybe they want to be miserable. You know, like, obviously there are some people like, man, leave me alone, I want to be miserable. In which case I say, well, I don't really care what you want. I'd rather you be happy. You know, and that's my, you know, my preference being imposed in a sense. Obviously it's all no imposition. It's all voluntary what we're talking about. Sure. And that's the best way to achieve that harmony. And that really, that it's, you know, if you're trying to be selfless, you're actually going to be less capable of being generous and giving and empathetic, and that's so much more important.
In the transition, and I appreciate you sharing these experiences with your parents. And it, as you were talking, I was just contemplating who you are and how you sort of manifested very similar qualities to your dad and to your mom, respectively. When you went from the prep school in Colorado to this Native American school, from a cultural standpoint, and being the only white kid there, what was that like? I mean, did that do anything to you? Did that change your perspective on the world at all? Just that part of it, not the schools, but the
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was extremely valuable, and it was a very humbling experience that just, you know, most white people in America, or most people who are in the ethnic majority in their society, don't get to experience, to be an absolute minority. And when I went there and toured, you know, I went on a visit before we signed up, I asked a couple of the students there. I went and visited one of the dorms and was sitting around with some of these guys, and I just said, well, what do you think of a white student coming here?
Uh-huh.
And with 63 students, they actually already had 32 different tribes represented, and a lot of them were half white anyway. They said, well, just that much more diversity. And so I got to be the token white student, and it was a wonderful experience. I came in as a junior, and I wasn't a big dude. I mean, there were a couple guys there who were like, who could have crushed me in a fight if they wanted to, but I was big enough, nobody was just going to pick on me.
Uh-huh.
And it was a small enough school that there was really almost no bullying, that I recall. It was really a great community that way. So I was accepted, and I was, you know, I was a nice guy. I was generous as I could be. And I felt completely accepted. And at the same time, I did get this really powerful experience of just understanding a little bit. I mean, just a taste in a very unique and very low-stakes kind of context, what it was like to be, you know, the only white student in an entire school. And, you know, there were white teachers and administrators, although most of them were Native American as well. So, I mean, it was an amazing experience. I met amazing people, and I had amazing relationships, and I have people I'm friends with to this day from then.
Were the kids curious about your life and the way you grew up, and did you see things about Native American culture that you would never have have ever considered in terms of?
I wouldn't say they were particularly curious about me, just as another fellow, just as a friend. Uh-huh. You know, they didn't make any special deal out of it. I mean, they're really chill out about it. I think I got a unique experience of Native American culture, although distorted by the boarding school experience, getting to be in touch with so many different tribal backgrounds and experiences there. And, you know, what the big takeaway for me is that, you know, this is an oppressed population that suffers greatly from the crimes of the past. Mm-hmm. and still lives in many ways in a just lower level of poverty than every comparable demographic in the rest of the country. So getting a sense of that and the challenge and the unique pride of the Native American community, I don't even like to collectivize it like that, because, you know, every tribe's experience is totally different. Every individual's experience is totally different. You know, there are people who grow up living in trailers and huts on reservations and, you know, are full-blooded natives. And there are people who grow up in, you know, high-rise condos to parents that are, you know, still full-blood native, but have completely adopted a mainstream American lifestyle. So there's that old range of experiences there as well. So I would be very hesitant in any way to, like, say I've been able to make any collective judgments about Native American culture, but I did get some very valuable windows into it and appreciation of experiences that were totally different from mine.
One of the things that seems to be universal with Native American culture, and obviously this is not a good example because people are coming from different walks of life within that particular school, but it is the respect for nature, and there's a in terms of spirituality, there's a whole another level there, and I don't know if you had a chance to see some of those benefits.
Oh yes, yeah. Oh yes, I definitely got my share of exposure to ceremonial experiences as well.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, listen, we're going to have to take a short break. We have our special guest, Adam Kokesh. You're listening to The Flow with Kurt Wallace. We will be back on the flip side. We have Adam Kokesh with us. You're listening to The Flow with Kurt Wallace. And Adam, let's get into what happens from graduating college and then going into the Marine Corps. You went in the Marine Corps, was it 1999? Is that right?
Yeah. And yeah, I was 17 years old. It was the year before I graduated high school. I signed up for the delayed entry program, which is like you commit and you get to go whenever you can. And we had a good program there. We were supposed to go once a month. Of course, at boarding school, I only made like three or four, but we had these pre-boot camp training events. And
okay.
Then, so I went when I was 18.
Ah, okay. So you were in the reserve originally. You enlisted in the reserve. And then,
that was the delayed entry program. That was before you joined. But then also, yes, I joined in the reserves. And then I did two activations as a reservist.
I gotcha. What made you decide to do this?
I wanted to have my life on the line for something I believed in. And the Marine Corps, you know, it's funny to be so propagandized as to not recognize that joining the military and essentially signing up to kill for politicians, to be a cog in the machine, to be paid with stolen funds of taxation, that is really very anti-freedom. And if you don't know that, then to a kid like me, the rebellious streak of the Marine Corps, Uncle Sam's misguided children and all that, has a particular appeal. And I was a tough kid who wanted to prove himself and all that stuff as well.
Mm, yeah. And so in doing this, you went to Fallujah. Yeah. And this was
I tortured people. I helped kill people.
How do you reconcile with that?
It's been a long journey. It's been a lot of deliberate work on myself and awareness of my traumatic experiences and the effects that they had on me. And, you know, more so than that, I really, I have a, you know, very guilty conscience about this, and I'm, you know, it's one of the things I'm working on building my awareness of now, because I treated PTSD with marijuana, and that really just treats the symptoms. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd like to be able to develop the healthier habits to deal with it without needing marijuana at all. And it's a side effect of weed. And I still love weed, and it's great to use on a limited basis, but I have to take a hard break and say that I quit recently because I was using it too much, and it was kind of keeping me disconnected from people around me. But the thing about this experience really is that I feel a lot of guilt, and I was really motivated by that, especially in the beginning of my activism, which was with the Rock Veterans Against the War. Mm-hmm. And what came to me slowly as an awareness was that in a just world, I would be dead. That, you know, the torture story is they're relatively mild and straightforward, but it was two detainees in a room who had sandbags over their heads and were zip tied with their hands behind their backs, forced to sit upright and sit in their own excrement. And I just was assigned to guard them for a 4-hour shift. And my job was to keep them awake and sitting up. And I used the Arabic that I taught myself in the spirit of helping people in civil affairs and being better with that to taunt them. And, you know, I don't want to say it haunts me, you know, because that would be an exaggeration, but it's a guilt that propelled my activism first with the Iraq Veterans Against the War. And I took to that the same attitude that I had with the Marines. Like, I was willing to die for this crap. Of course I'm willing to get arrested for protesting. Yeah, let's do it. You know, I had no qualms about that. And I was involved with a lot of, you know, high profile, high risk kind of, not quite civil disobedience technically, but, you know, illegal protesting or pushing the boundaries protesting. And, you know, I've now been arrested over 3 dozen times. Most of those were for protesting arrests, but you know, a lot of them now for civil disobedience as well. And if I may get on to something that I think your audience might appreciate, is a big myth about me, mm-hmm. which is that people think I'm brave, and it's totally not true. And I hope from hearing a little bit of my backstory here that people get a sense that, like, I'm really not that special, you know. And in describing my activism, mm-hmm. I say that, you know, I've had a lot of perseverance, and I spent a lot of time developing the skill set necessary to do what I do. But a lot of people in activism come and go. It's easy to stay when you got lucky like me and basically won the lottery 10 times in a row. And you don't see all the tickets, you know, that I've lost on laying around on the ground, all the, you know, actions I took that never got any attention or that didn't succeed in any way or didn't raise any money or whatever the case may be. But if you can, you know, if you knew that you were going to win the lottery 1 out of 100 times, you'd be buying a lot more lottery tickets, right? And so that's kind of how I view my activism. And I think most people don't do what I'm about to explain that I do, that I do think is special and allows me to have a different perspective on taking risks and activism when you're as overwhelmed by fear and what you're doing as I am. Uh-huh. And I really am scared of cops. I'm scared of government. I'm scared of dying. I'm scared of being hurt. I'm scared of going to jail. Uh-huh. And, you know, yet I've done, I mean, I don't want to, like, get into comparison, but I don't know if there are even, you know, maybe more than a handful of activists who have consistently faced the kind of arrest risk in their activism that I have. And, you know, I did 4 months in jail for loading a shotgun, and 2 of those were in solitary. And I did a week in solitary, essentially, with one other person. Special lockup in Philly with an APO. And I've been roughed up by cops before. I faced all of that. So what I do differently is not be more courageous, because that doesn't help you out tactically at all. It doesn't help you come up with better ideas. That doesn't help you strategize. That doesn't help you prioritize. Courage is for when you're dumb. Courage is for the uncertainty. What I do that's unique in calculating the risk and reward is take out a lot of the uncertainty. And when people see the risk of getting arrested as part of protesting, it is often raised in their minds as a giant X factor, like literally X, like in algebra, could be anything, infinite, like, oh my gosh, if I'm going to interact with the police, I could die.
Yes.
And it's worth thinking about that. I don't mean that you shouldn't acknowledge that, but you should be able to quantify those risks and look at it in a little bit more of a numerical way for whatever particular situation you're in, and understand that really talking to a cop on the street, you know, while it's a lot more dangerous than just walking past without saying anything, you know, your risk is still extremely low. And then on the other side of the equation, it's the calculation of the reward. And for one, I know that enough reward for me will be being able to tell my grandkids, I did what I could when the time came to take government apart and establish a free society. I was there. I was doing what I did, what I had to do to get us here. You know, I was right there. I was not one of these people that sat idly by and let government get out of control. Not only did I put the brakes on it, but I stopped the bleeding at the high tide of government, but I helped move humanity forward from there. I don't know that I can say how effective I will have been in historical hindsight, but I darn sure know well I'm going to be able to tell my grandkids that I did everything I could on that count. And that's payoff enough to recognize that that is way more valuable than the slight risk of loss that you face on the other side. It should be enough for everybody to do what I do, but or at least, you know, have the confidence in their calculations to be able to apply this to their own life. But I look even further and think of, or even more, you know, mundane on the benefit side. Like, I'm going to get more YouTube views if I get arrested. I'm going to get more attention for my cause. I'm going to wake more people up. I'm going to build my reputation, and all of those things factor in. And if you have confidence in your ability to capitalize on those things, and it's not for personal gain, I mean, I live well. I live comfortably. I have no qualms about that. And I'm building myself a house, which in and of itself here is an act of civil disobedience that scares the crap out of me. Like, really, they could come and steal my property because I didn't get permits for what I'm doing here. That scares the crap out of me. But I have enough confidence in putting myself in this as a win-win situation. So if you can take the uncertainty out of both sides of the equation, then it's a lot easier to do the things that other people mistake as courageous, and that's why people mistakenly think that I am.
In terms of the uncertainty, then, in your experiences, all the things that have happened, I mean, obviously going to Iraq, I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty there, even though it is, you have the U.S. military behind you. Coming back and facing the realities of what actually is going on with these unconstitutional wars. But you get up on stage at the Rally for the Republic. I remember, I don't know if you even remember us meeting behind the stage, and we did this interview together I think it was Break the Matrix at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember Break the Matrix back in the day from those 2008.
Yeah, way back. And there are some key moments that I remember that made an impact on me, that when I was watching you, there was something about what you were doing and what you have done when you stood there on stage talking about the Tree of Liberty. And then going to, is it Nassau, New York, and a group of you guys were protesting the McCain-Obama debate and wanting to go in and just ask a question. The police trampled, I think, crushed one of your buddy's heads.
Yeah, man, I haven't heard. It's been a long time since I've even tried to think about that night. But yeah, I sat on the police bus, handcuffed
for no reason.
Bleeding out of his face because he had gotten stepped on by a horse, and all of us screaming at the cops, get this guy the frick out of here to a hospital, because this you just trampled, like, and there was the video of this is out there. Nick Morgan, man, I haven't talked to him in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so after that, you know, I mean,
it's a scary thing dealing with this because you don't know what's going to happen. That didn't get any media coverage. It was on Democracy Now.
Right. It was a horse back. It was a police officer on a horse running into a crowd, turning around, backing up deliberately.
On veterans. This is a crowd of veterans.
A group of veterans.
We're not talking about a riot. We're talking about guys just standing there. There's video of this. And so in the uncertainty, is there any moments in your experience of being arrested that you thought, okay, it could be like talking to somebody in jail or, you know, an experience with a police officer or something where a shift occurred for you?
I mean, I've always been shifting. if I may change the subject slightly,
uh-huh,
and come back to answering your question, one of the things that people come up to me now, you know, people used to come up to me when they met me at events or just would recognize me on the street or at the airport. Hey, man, I love this thing that you did. Hey, getting arrested at the Jefferson. Hey, the thing with the shotgun. Hey, I saw you banner drop McCain, that was awesome.
Right, fan but what events.
What I've started to get now is I really appreciate how you've evolved.
Mm.
And I think that's the greatest compliment. I mean, I can never get sick of being approached by strangers telling me such beautiful things. And because I started my activism as an angry man.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think I was really angry. But I was driven by anger, and it really characterized that, and it was driven by ego.
Mm.
And a lot of people who come to this message of freedom first are here because we had to be right about things. You know, obviously now we stick around because we want to help move humanity forward, but the intellectual process, that's usually not enough to drive it.
Mm.
Yeah. And I've recently even, you know, adopted nonviolent communication in my activism. And one of my favorite videos, I think it's up to like 400,000 views now, is called Would-Be Bully Gets Kokesh, Nonviolent Communication in Action. And it's a guy who was like this monster of a man, this veteran who was like just a human ox and a head taller than me. And I'm not a small dude, but he made me look tiny. And he came down and was like, because he overheard from somebody else, did you say something bad about the military? I'm going to take you outside.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like, wow, you feel angry, don't you? And I was able to completely talk him down and talk him into taking a book eventually.
I remember that video. I was really impressed with that,
It was
an unexpected reaction that you had to him that didn't fuel his anger or his ego, and you gave him respect, and he ended up, I think, shaking your hand, or I don't know if you...
Yeah. And I've become a much better messenger, being able to be positive and to be patient with people. And I had to realize for myself, this is not a political message. Freedom is not a political issue. It is the anti-political issue. It is an issue of ethics and morality and respect for basic human rights and self-ownership and achieving a state of universal nonviolence in the world. That's what it's really about. And if you go and you think of it as a political message, you're going to find yourself arguing with people.
Mm.
And the first person to win every argument is the first one to stop arguing. And if we stop arguing, we can share this message from the perspective of, hey, I've got these beautiful ideas. Can I share them with you? We're so much more effective. And so people who have seen me go through that and been able to be challenged in everything about who I am and to continue to grow and change, have really been able to benefit from that now. And I think it's also a rare thing that someone, you know, I mean, my start in activism was Iraq Veterans Against the War. Like, hello, what were you thinking? You know, you did the war, but you're against it now. Okay, like, I get it, but at least you're admitting that you were wrong. Most people who come out as activists and think of themselves as public figures don't allow themselves that space to evolve and to grow. And I've been very fortunate to just have been, from the beginning, yep, that was wrong. That thing I did, totally wrong. So I've always been kind of comfortable changing my mind publicly. And it's been a great blessing because it's allowed other people around me to change their minds too. And if we want to change the world, we want to change the paradigm, we have to get people to change their minds, and arguing with people doesn't work.
That's interesting. I have noticed there are, as you're talking, and I've never really thought of this observation, but there are activists who grow old becoming more and more bitter, and
they grow out of relevance.
Yeah. They grow out of, they kind of disappear. And in this sort of evolution that you're talking about, and I've seen it too. Do you regret anything you did in terms of your activism? And if so, what was it?
Oh no, if a regret is something that was a waste of your time, you're only going to waste more time regretting it. So I really don't look back with regret. I don't do that. I recognize my mistakes. I learn lessons, but my attitude towards my past is totally free of regret. I have lived life well and enthusiastically and fully, and life is too short to even look at your past that way. So okay. I'm able to look at everything. I mean, you know, I either win or I lose, so I only win.
Fair enough.
I'm sorry. I totally screwed that up. Either win or I learn, so I'm always winning. And
greatest lesson from your activism then.
Yeah.
What is your greatest lesson? Is it to not approach it from an ego standpoint, or as an overall?
Oh, I don't know, man. Greatest singular lesson from my activism? I don't know if there is one.
Okay.
I guess it would be that if you want to, it would be just what I said earlier, that if you want to change the world, you have to change how people think. There's no way around it. You know, even if you don't care about freedom, you can't really beat people into submission to your ideas.
Yeah.
You know, you can't yell at them and get them to change their mind.
Let's shift gears now. And you've been in a very serious relationship. And we talked prior to the interview about it's ended. You were engaged. Do you mind talking about that?
No, I was, it was an intense experience for me. My ex fiance Macy Tallman is an amazing woman. I will always have a special place in my heart for her. It's been an incredible experience getting to live with her for this past nearly 2 years. Mm-hmm. And in realizing that we weren't able to meet each other's long-term needs, we went through a lot of pain and difficulty because we both really wanted this to work, I believe. And it was a great, we're not even done with the process right now. This is all still very fresh for me.
Yeah.
And, you're never going to lose if you're always learning. And that's, I wish I was better at relationships in a number of ways, better at setting them up and being properly selective I'm a hopeless romantic. I'm always optimistic. And I think if you know that your assessment of reality is going to be off by a certain percentage point anyway, you want to err, and you have a choice of erring positive or negative. I stand behind always erring on the positive side. And I think that's still true about relationships. I'm always too trusting. I'm too forgiving.
Yeah.
That leads me into difficult situations. But, no, man, I don't know what else to say right now.
No. We're going to have to take a short break. We have our special guest, Adam Kokesh, with us. And you're listening to The Flow with Kurt Wallace. We'll be back on the flip side. We have our special guest, Adam Kokesh, with us today. You're listening to The Flow with Kurt Wallace. And Adam, we were talking about relationships before the break. You just had you're actually in the process of ending the relationship. And is there anything specific that you want to talk about with that, or should we move on to the next topic?
If there was something else that you wanted to dig for in that, but I'm happy to move on.
No, not at all. In terms of your spirituality, what is that for you?
I've never been particularly concerned with spiritual issues, but I've always been concerned with having a strong intellectual confidence in whatever spirituality that I did embrace. And so I've never been a fan of any kind of dogmatic religion, and was led from being an agnostic who was open to everything to being an atheist, and an outspoken atheist, even for a brief period. And where I've come to now, where I feel much more comfortable, is pantheism, which is to embrace the divinity of everything, that nature is God, everything is God, the universe is God. There is no such thing as God separate from the universe, but rather pervasive in the universe. And that is just a way of embracing the beauty of the experience of being a human. To me, that's the best approach. That's, you know, kind of how I came to settle on it. And it really doesn't contradict anything of atheism, which doesn't really address a lot of, you know, bigger spiritual issues, or how then shall we live, or how to relate to the universe. And obviously atheism is a very limited concept, and I don't mean, I think it has a very important place in any human's understanding of the universe. And yet, as an atheist, I don't want to say like you're missing out on something, but I felt that I was in denial of my own humility as a human being, that I have to look at the universe, I have to experience life as a person who goes, wow, holy crap, every day, all the time, just surrounding me, this is an amazing experience, wow. You know, I can't comprehend how overwhelmingly beautiful and incredible it is to be a human being alive in the universe today. Like, wow. And so to me, pantheism is the, you know, one word way of expressing that.
And today you're in Arizona. You're building is it an Earthship style home?
That's a good way of describing it, yes.
Okay. And
Earthship-inspired building.
What is your world like right now? You have the Freedom Line. Can you talk about all of that? We only have a couple of minutes left, and want to be able to get people to your website and find out, you know, whatever you want them to find out about today.
Sure, thanks. Yeah, the website is thefreedomline.com, thefreedomline.com. You can find everything about me there, including the free downloads of our audiobook, Freedom, which I wrote when I was in jail, or started at least, in order to be the most efficient tool for sharing this worldview with other people. And it's been an amazing success, and it's fourth printing now, and with over 2 million downloads. It's been an incredible wave to feel building underneath me right now, and I get to ride this wave till the end of government. And it's just we just got our fourth translation Spanish done today, after wow. Turkish, Chinese, and Korean, all done by volunteers. So it's just been amazing to feel this growing. People are buying the book in bulk in order to pass out and share with their friends. So we are just rock and rolling with that. We've got our store online, which is a nice way to support this financially.
If people want to donate, you can donate through our website as well. We definitely take Bitcoin all the way. And my YouTube channel, you can find that through there. We just hit 50 million views, 200,000 subscribers. Nice big benchmarks there. And this is, now I am running, I'm preparing, we are building the organization for Kokesh 2020. I am running for not president. That is that when elected, I will not be president. I will sign one executive order declaring that the federal government is no longer of any authority and initiating the proper responsible administrative process for dissolving it.
Now, how do people, do they not vote for a not president, or how does that work?
No, you can go out and vote, but I don't know that this is how it's going to happen. You know, government might collapse on its own. The most important thing one way or another is that we draw a line in the sand and we bring people to the side of righteousness.
Adam Kokesh, thanks for spending time with us today on The Flow.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The Flow with Kurt Wallace, brought to you by Veritas Radio Network. Executive producer Mike Church, producer Sarah Remini, tech producer Don Naylor, and creative director Benito Segovia. We'll see you next time.